Welcome to this encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie unveiled its Take a Stand Center back in October. It's a new multi-million dollar immersive exhibition that's been in the works for almost 3 years. According to the Illinois Holocaust Museum, the Take a Stand Center was created to focus on social justice issues and to move visitors, quote, from knowledge to inspiration to action. In total, there are three new galleries and roughly 4,000 feet of added floor space. At the heart of the Take a Stand Center, though, is the Abe and Ida Cooper Survivor Stories Experience, which uses groundbreaking 3D technology to tell the stories of 13 individuals who lived through the Holocaust, including several from the Chicago area. Conceptually, this is an effort to move the museum's archive into the 21st century with holographic interview recordings that let visitors come face-to-face with the survivors in a lifelike way, and voice recognition technology gives museum guests the power to interact and actually ask those holographs important questions. We're going to be hearing from one of those 13 survivors, a Chicago-era resident, later in the program. But first, Susan Abrams is the CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum. She joins us on the line from Skokie to tell us more about the exhibit. Susan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Glad to be chatting with you.
You know, when we're learning about this, it seems like such an amazing experience, especially the ability to have a digital interaction with Holocaust survivors. How did you first come up with this whole idea?
That's a great question. We had been grappling with how will we tell survivor stories in the most compelling ways for generations to come. As you know, most survivors are in their 80s and 90s now, and it is one of the great benefits of coming to our museum that all of our student and educator groups and many of our public visitors, too, have that opportunity to not only tour our world-class exhibitions and attend our programs, but also to hear directly from a survivor. And so we've put together a range of different strategies, but the most exciting is what you've been talking about. And the idea originated from one of our board members who wanted to be able to interview survivors holographically to present their stories three-dimensionally. And serendipitously, he discovered that the University of Southern California Shoah Foundation was working on just that very thing, not only the holographic piece of it, but marrying custom voice recognition software so that you can literally have a conversation with a recorded survivor. And no matter how many times I describe this and experiment with different words to use, I uniformly find that our visitors are amazed by it nonetheless. You can't really prepare for it of that when people draw a breath, when the survivor appears three-dimensionally on screen and then real-time answers their questions so that you're sitting there having a conversation.
Yeah, it sounds like something from a movie, right? It sounds like very Star Trek or any some other sci-fi. How does it work? What questions can you ask them?
You can ask absolutely any question to the survivor about their life before the war. What was it like growing up in France or Germany or wherever they were? Tell me about your family life. And then you can ask, were you in a ghetto? Were you in a concentration camp? Who from your family survived? What was it like in the camps? How did you survive? Do you believe in God? What, you know, all those kinds of questions, anything and everything, as well as some fun questions, too.
What kind of fun questions can you ask them? I'm curious.
The kids often ask, and we knew that, so these questions have been asked of the recorded survivors, what's your favorite question? Could you sing a song? Can you tell a joke? Those kinds of things. They do occasionally do it, absolutely. And many times, to the surprise of the audience, the recorded survivor can answer it. And if not, they've been trained, the software will redirect of, oh, let's talk about something else, or I don't know about that. Can you ask me a different question?
Yeah, kind of like what Siri does, right? When you ask Siri a question and Siri doesn't know the
steroids,
answer.
On steroids, I would say.
Exactly.
It puts Siri to shame, I must confess.
Susan, why do you think it's important for people to not only be able to hear survivor stories, but to be able to experience them in this way?
Yeah, we all know that most people learn best and something imprints by doing and engaging. And again, with the internet, we're also used to driving our own content and knowledge acquisition. And here you can take the conversation in a direction of things that interest you. And it feels that much more personal. We also know that pedagogically, there's no substitute for that interaction, human being to human being, for making people aware of our common humanity. And it's a wonderful supplement to the world-class exhibitions that we offer, and really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity at this point. This is absolutely the future of the preservation of history, and thank goodness just in the time to capture this critical piece of our world history.
What does the museum have planned?
We have a day-long set of activities. Our survivors will be on hand, and you can talk to them. I think the very most exciting thing is to experience the exhibition itself, in addition to our holographic theater where you can have a conversation with a recorded survivor. We have two other galleries for people, our Goodman Upstander Gallery and our Take a Stand Lab. And in those areas, we make the connections from the history and lessons of the Holocaust, and where our visitors will learn the dangers of hatred and prejudice and, importantly, indifference, and the power of their voices and choices to affect change. We'll link that power and responsibility of our own, each individual to speak out to make our world a better place, to those upstanders as opposed to bystanders, who are making a difference in our world today in all different areas. It could be working for equal education access, for safe communities, for health access and a healthy environment. So we look at a range of issues in the areas of civil rights, social rights, environmental rights, and economic rights, and give people real life and life-size interactives of the people who are doing these things every day. Some are famous, like Malala or John Lewis or Carly Lloyd, the Olympian soccer player, and others could be your neighbor or mine. And so we want it to feel accessible but inspirational for people. And then in the third gallery, once they're inspired, we give them the tools. How do you advocate? How do you spread the word? How do you join or found an organization? You can do things in the museum and share what you will be doing, and then you can email yourself tools to take home as well.
I'm speaking with Susan Abrams. She's CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum. She's on the line from Skokie. We're talking more about the new Take a Stand Center. As Susan's been saying, it's not just about the Holocaust, about social justice issues, about bridging all of this to contemporary social justice. And Susan, I wanted to play something for our audience here. It's a clip you all provided us that does a good job of capturing what you've been talking about. Let's take a listen to this.
How strong do you have to be a survivor, to fight on just so others can live on through your stories, the narrator that never dies? For you listening, may you always stand out and up. Continue to educate. Never think your reach is too short. You're never too young to teach. Create safe communities. Turn clay into pots of gold. Build and rebuild. Create and recreate. Fight for equality. Even when the playing field isn't even, may your individual fights become collective victories. Use your voice. Use your art. Take history to heart. Take a stand for humanity. Never be silenced. Be a survivor. Be an upstander. Be the answer.
That is spoken word poet Harold Green from Chicago, part of the new Take a Stand Center at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Harold is an example, I think, of how you're bridging Holocaust stories to contemporary social justice. How did you decide who went into this? How did you pick, for example, Harold?
Our education department, we partner all the time with a range of different organizations from throughout the Chicagoland area and beyond. For our programs and student leadership days and teacher trainings, we regularly bring people in from around the country, but they had a relationship and it turned out to be just right.
Is there a favorite part of the center for you?
I have to say that perhaps the biggest wow, as one might expect, is with this opportunity to have a conversation with a survivor hologram, if you will. And I think that is, of course, my very favorite. But I love the opportunity to move from there into the Upstander Gallery, which is truly a visual feast. We have these story pods that are life-size, lit from behind, interactive photos, touch screens, where you can pick those upstanders and the areas that they're working on that are most exciting to you. So if you're interested in education, you can pick from 5 different upstanders who are working to create educational access for all. Or if you're interested in the environment, there are 5 others, and the visuals are stunning and life-size, and you can go as deep as you want as you touch and scroll and hear from those upstanders. So I think it's a wonderful complement and way to move from history to our world today and to excite people about engaging to do their part to make our world a better place.
That's Susan Abrams. She's CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum. She's been telling us about the new Take a Stand Center. We have the real life person of one of these holographic images who's joining us as well. As we've said, part of the exhibition she's been talking about is the ability to have an interaction with a holographic image based on stories of survivors, some of them from the Chicago area. Fritzi Fritschall is with us now on the line. Fritzi, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Fritzi, what's it like to see a holographic image of yourself?
You know, it's really difficult. I haven't accepted it yet. I sit there and I watch it and I criticize and the way I sat or whatever. I'm not sure. I sit there and keep looking at it and I'm not sure how I feel about it other than the fact of what it has done and what is left behind by having this holography in the museum. As far as watching myself, it's very difficult. And it's difficult because I sat in a chair for 5 days where I was being interviewed from the time they brought me all the way back. They took me back to the time I was 3 or 4 years old and family and what we lived like. Then they took me into the darkest, darkest days of our history, which was the camp itself, Auschwitz concentration camp. They kept questioning me about that and what was it like and how did I live there and how did I survive with all the others there. And then they bring me back into today of where I live today, what I do today. And the transformation is difficult to come out of Auschwitz, because I have the tendency to put myself right back in there. I was right back in that boxcar going to Auschwitz concentration camp. I saw a mother holding a dead baby from lack of air, from lack of food, from lack of water. I saw my own grandfather die in this boxcar being taken to the concentration camp. I saw the separation. I saw my mother being taken into a different line. I saw my brothers going into a line that would go to the gas chambers. So doing all of this was very, very difficult. And at the end of the day, it was very difficult for me to deprogram myself and come into today, to today's century, to today's freedom. So it was a difficult thing to do, but I feel that I did it for the right reasons. I did it for humanity. I did it for tomorrow, for your children, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren, when we survivors are no longer here to tell our story. I did it so that the revisionists cannot change history. And so these are the reasons that I sat in that chair and did it for.
Fritzi, thanks for sharing that with us. We have to take a break, but if you don't mind, I'd like to, after the break, if we could talk a little bit more about that experience. Stay tuned, folks. We're talking to Fritzi Fritschall, Chicago area resident, Holocaust survivor. She's sharing how her story has now been transformed into a new holographic experience at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Welcome back to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been speaking with the Illinois Holocaust Museum's CEO, Susan Abrams, about the museum's Take a Stand Center they unveiled in October. Those who visit the new center will have the opportunity to come face-to-face and digitally interact with 13 Holocaust survivors thanks to groundbreaking holographic displays and voice recognition technology. We've been talking to one of those featured survivors. Seven of them, by the way, are from the Chicago area. Fritzi Fritschall is with us. She was born in 1929 in Czechoslovakia. Fritzi, so you were just telling us about sitting in that chair for 5 days and going through the story of your whole life. You said your inclination is to go back to the camp, to Auschwitz, to those such awful, I imagine, those memories that are just something that is seared into your mind. I wonder, when you were talking to the folks who were interviewing you, were there other memories that from before that you kind of maybe hadn't thought about in a while of your childhood before you were a young teenager?
Well, you know what? We all have a tendency to forget certain things and to put certain things away. And yes, I mean, when I was a teenager, I had a wonderful life. I came from a wonderful family, and my memories are absolutely great of those days. But then they take you away from those days, and they put you into the ghettos, and they put you into the concentration camps. And to live in Auschwitz, and you know, I'm often asked, and especially through all of this, what was it like in Auschwitz? How did you live? How did you survive? So I'm going to tell you that there's no way that any survivor that lived through Auschwitz can really tell you the story in one day or 2 days or in a week. It is a horrendous story. But my story is that I had help. I had help a man when they were getting us off the boxcars, a man who was brought to Auschwitz, who was Jewish, who knew what was going on already. His job was to empty the boxcar and to get the dead people off. He walked amongst children like myself, and he kept whispering, when you get off, you're 15, remember. So I came on as a 13-year-old and got off as a 15-year-old because of what he did. He saved my life because he knew that most children under the age of 15 would line up and go to the gas chambers, as did my two younger brothers. I stood in line with my mother. This is where the separation came. This is where the men and women were separated. This is where families were torn apart. This is where the dogs were getting at you, and the punishment, and the guns, and the confusion, and your adrenaline is such that you don't know what's happening around you. So the men and women were separated. I stood with my mother in line. And then they came and called age. And I looked at my mother and sent her into a different line. I didn't want her to be beaten there. I didn't want the dogs to get at her. So she listened to me and went into a different line. When I asked afterwards when I would see my mother, they pointed to the smoke. So the line I sent her into went directly to the gas chambers. And so I've been living with this. Could she have lived if she had stayed with me? So this has been a heaviness to carry. Then I was taken out of Auschwitz, and I was put to work into a factory. The factory I was put to work in, where we did slave labor, was so horrendous. It was so much worse. Hunger and fear and everything there was just terrible. And so I was one of 600 women doing slave labor, and I was the youngest. I was the baby. In the camps, in Auschwitz, and all over, for all of us at that point was, who will survive and who will tell the story? This is what we talked about at night. Who will survive, and will the world know The world is standing by quietly now. We have absolutely no help in the concentration camps. We need help. Where is help? And who will believe us? Who will believe that humanity can do such horrendous things to other human beings? And so while I did slave labor with these 599 women, when the bread came at night, which was a tiny, tiny piece of bread, we were all starving. When the bread came at night, I would stand, and 599 women would give one tiny crumb of their bread and put it into the palm of my hand, because I was chosen as the one that would survive. I was chosen as the one that would live and get the story if anybody survived from those days and what was going on there. The chances for me survival were better than for others because of my youth. I was young. And so these 599 women shared their precious, precious crumbs of bread that they maybe could have survived another day on. But I took on the responsibility of being the survivor and being the messenger if I survived. And so, obviously, here I am. Mm-hmm. But it's this many years later, and yeah. I have carried this story with me all of these many years. So for many, many years, did not, would not, could not speak about it. And then when I started to, when I joined the Holocaust Museum, and when my son came to me and asked me and said, because he needed to know his mother's story. And so this is when I became the survivor this many, many years later. And so the holography that I have done is in memory of those 599 women. It is in memory of my mother, my brothers, my extended family, the 6 million that cannot speak for themselves and others that were killed during the time of the Holocaust, the 1.5 million babies that they gassed. And so while I sat in that chair and I was grilled and I was going through all of this in my mind, I was doing it for those people so that their stories can live in the future and years to come when we are no longer here. And so I feel that maybe through holography, when the students will see me, I'm planting a seed. I'm hoping that when they go home, tell their parents, and maybe look up a book, and maybe watch it on television, and maybe be interested enough to learn about the past, and maybe learn of what really, really happened to us during that particular time.
Fritzi, thank you so much for sharing your story again. We're speaking with Fritzi Fritschall, a Chicago area resident, who's one of the people featured in the new Illinois Holocaust Museum's Take a Stand Center that opens this weekend. The CEO of the museum has been on the line with us as well. Susan, as we hear Fritzi share her story, and we know often we hear that we should never forget, I wonder how you feel listening to the story again, why again it was so important for you to be able to have the story told and then have it told with this new technology on top of it, right? Of having, introducing this story to new generations.
Yeah. We think it's imperative to be able to tell these stories because with every year that passes from the Holocaust, there are fewer and fewer people who know somebody who was impacted. And this just brings it to people in the most personal way. We're on the phone and over radio right now, but when you look somebody in the eyes and see their expressions as they're sharing these stories, you get such a different sense again of what it means to be a human being and think about our common humanity and how could these things happen one human being to another and how can I prevent that from happening in the future? And I think a number of the questions that I've heard asked lend thinking in that direction. Fritzi alluded to some of those who helped her to stay alive, and that's true of all survivor stories. is that it took many, many different things for somebody to survive against all odds, but often the help of a number of different human beings. And so I think people, we hope, while learning about a devastating time, also come out with an understanding again of the power of their voice and their choices to affect an individual's life or even a community trajectory. So I think that's really exciting. I think that because we're able to do this in a holographic theater and with this interactive conversational component, and we're the first in the world to do this, I think it brings a broader interest base and an excitement to these stories and will enable us to touch and impact more people with this important history.
What does it mean to have someone like Fritzi play such a big role in the museum, Susan?
It is one of my greatest privileges as an employee here, a staff member, a CEO, to have the opportunity to work with Fritzi on a daily basis and to see the generosity and strength and courage that she and her fellow survivors embody. As she mentioned, she not only lived through this difficult history, but she is willing to share day in and day out, as other members of our Speakers Bureau are too, with our visitors these experiences. And it's all about impacting the future, trying to make never again a reality. And we do it one visitor at a time. And if we can, you know, change one person's life, maybe they change another person's life and another. And I think that's part of how we improve our world.
And as you say that, as we think back to not just the story that the Fritzi has just shared now, but at the beginning of our conversation, Susan, of the whole idea of this Take a Stand Center is to talk about contemporary social justice issues. And I'm thinking in particular about when we hear stories of genocide. Fritzi, I'm thinking in particular of the news reports of the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Fritzi, when you hear those stories, is this, I wonder what goes through your mind?
You know, we live in a very, very different kind of a world. We live in a difficult time right now. It is difficult for me as a survivor when the president does not recognize the Holocaust on Holocaust Remembrance Day, when I see what is happening around the world now. It makes me very sad, and it scares me. And that is one of the reasons that we stand up and speak out, because what goes around comes around. And it scares me that we have not learned much from the past. And this is what we're trying to do. This is what all of us are trying to do, to make a better world, to have a better world, and to include all kinds of people into our world of today, not to exclude anyone, because we all feel the same, we all bleed the same. And by presenting this and by standing up and by speaking out, I feel that I myself can touch some people maybe, where they can stand up and, as Susan said, they can become the upstander and not the bystander, because the bystanders were our neighbors during that particular time. And at that point, nobody stood up and nobody spoke up out for us. So we are trying to leave a better world for our children and grandchildren.
And as you say that, Fritzi, I wonder, so much of this museum is about us learning from past generations, of us learning lessons that we can pass on to each other. What do you want us to learn about, as you said, this moment in our country and in our world?
I think what I want to learn is, what I want to leave behind is, we should touch each other. We should be aware of what is happening in the world today. We should stand up and speak out if we see something is wrong. We can make a better world. I alone cannot, but you and I together can leave and create a better world for our children and grandchildren. And so this is what I'm going to leave behind, and this is what I hope will happen.
Thank you for that, Fritzi. I wonder, as we think about lessons, Susan, I just want to ask about what you know, as we think about the museum, as Fritzi's talking about passing on important lessons from one generation to another, what has Fritzi passed on to you, Susan?
I think she has passed on her optimism in spite of all that she's been through and the sense of her strength and that commitment to making our world a better place. I know we have some students from all over our state and the Midwest, and actually as far away as Florida and Nebraska, who visit our museum. Some of them come from difficult backgrounds, and we regularly have students who come up to a survivor who's been a speaker, and they say, wow, I thought I had a heavy burden, but if you could get through what you did, I can get through what I did. So I think that's one thing that I'm struck by regularly. But I think that if somebody with Fritzi's experiences is willing to dedicate herself to making our world a better place, it only makes me want to double down and, you know, really support that and do everything in my power as well to stand up for those without a voice and to take action where I see something that could be better in our world.
That's Susan Abrams. She's CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie. Susan, thank you. I want to thank Fritzi Fritzschall as well, a survivor whose story is going to be chronicled in the museum's new Take a Stand Center. Fritzi, Susan, thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you for taking the time to share your stories
with us. Thank you, and thank you for doing this, and thank you for getting our story out there.
Thanks for listening to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In August of this year, a total solar eclipse covered the contiguous U.S. for the first time since 1971. And if you don't remember, one of the best places in the world to see it was in Cedar Lake, just south of Carbondale. This would be a once-in-a-lifetime event for all but the most dedicated eclipse chasers, but as it turns out, another one will be coming to Southern Illinois in 2024. With that, we'd revisit a conversation we had this past summer before the eclipse in August. We were joined by Phil Plate. You may know him as the Bad Astronomer. He's an astronomer, blogger, and head science writer for the Netflix show Bill Nye Saves the World. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Phil, for I think people, especially in Illinois, the news has been building about the total eclipse. But maybe you can explain, why is this such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal for a lot of reasons. One is that it's a rare phenomenon. You don't get a total solar eclipse in any particular spot on the Earth very often. Now, in general, they happen once or twice a year, but they're very specific. There might be one over Antarctica, over the Pacific Ocean. And so to have one over the continental United States hasn't happened in a long time and won't happen again for quite a few years. And the other reason is that this is a profoundly beautiful event. It's not just like a partial solar eclipse where the moon blocks a little bit of the sun. You wouldn't even notice that if you didn't know it was happening. This is the moon completely blocking the face of the sun. It actually starts to get dark out. Crickets will chirp. Birds will come out and sing, sort of twilight afternoon events happening in the middle of the day. And you also see the sun's atmosphere called the corona, which is not something you normally see. You only see it in pictures. And to be able to look and see that with your own eyes is an incredibly moving event. Or so I'm told, because I've never seen one. This will be my first.
I think this will be a first for a lot of people, right? If the first one was in 1979, or the most recent one was in 1979. Obviously, when we think about eclipses, there's a long history of people being fascinated by them, thinking of it as a, you know, before we knew more, before our scientific knowledge had evolved to where it is today, I think there were a lot of people who were obviously understandably very scared by them. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions still about eclipses, because you said you can look at it. And I wanted to ask you about that. What are the, what can you look at it? Is it safe to look at it? What other misconceptions do people maybe have about observing this eclipse?
Is it safe to look at it? Yes and no. We have to be careful here. The sun is very bright. Hello, I think everybody knows that. Looking at the sun for a split second isn't all that dangerous. Staring at it is not a good idea. Your eyes just really aren't built to handle that kind of light coming in very well, and it's even more dangerous for kids than adults. So you shouldn't do that. Once the sun is completely blocked by the moon, it's actually safe to look at, because the moon is covering the entire bright surface of the sun. The problem comes in after about 2 minutes. Let me phrase it this way. The moon partially blocks the sun for about an hour and a half. That starts in Illinois at about 11:52. At 1:20 in the afternoon, the moon will completely block the sun, and it'll stay that way for about 2 minutes. It depends on where you are. And once that's over and the moon passes the sun again, that's the most dangerous part for looking at it, because when it's dark, your pupils open up, it lets in more light, and then once the moon moves off, the bright sunlight could in fact damage your eye. So here's what I suggest. Up until the eclipse is total, make sure you're using safe viewing circumstances, whether that's eclipse glasses rated for safety or looking through a telescope that's outfitted correctly. You can find all that sort of information online. Once it's total, you're fine to look at it, but make sure your timing is something you're paying attention to, and give it a good 30 seconds, you know, and then don't look at it again with your eyes. Use something that's safe to look at it. But during that totality, yeah, it's safe to look at, and I'm very excited about seeing this myself for the first time.
Phil, we have people listening from all over Illinois. So I wanted to ask you first, why is Carbondale, why is Southern Illinois one of the best viewing places in the world? And if you're in the northern part of the state, or if you're further north, or if you're further east or northeast, like if you're in Chicago, what will you see then?
What's going on here is that the moon orbits the Earth, and usually it doesn't get that close to the sun, but this time everything is lined up just right so that the moon will pass directly in front of the sun. So basically what it's doing is it's casting its shadow on the Earth. And it just so happens that in the sky, the moon and the sun appear to be about the same size. It's a coincidence. But what that means is that if you're a little bit too far north or a little bit too far south, the moon won't completely block the sun. And so what you get is a partial eclipse. Now the sun is mostly blocked, but you need to block all of it to see the total eclipse. So that means that you have to be in a very narrow band going across the United States. You have to be inside this region to be able to see it. So if you're in, I'm looking at a map right now, Evansville, you're outside of the totality path. You're going to get a very close to total eclipse, like 99% of the sun will be blocked, but not total.
So how big is the window? How many miles is that?
In fact, the path of totality across the United States is pretty narrow. It's only about 60 miles wide. So if you're inside of that path, north of the southern region and south of the northern region of it, you'll get a total eclipse. And so if you're in Carbondale, Marion, I'm looking at the map right now of southern Illinois, Harrisburg, regions like that, you will see a total eclipse. Now, if you're right in the center of that path, that's going to maximize the length of time that the sun is blocked. And in fact, this is passing through the northwestern United States and the southeastern United States. The length of time the sun is blocked changes depending on where you are. And Carbondale, that area, is pretty much the greatest duration that anybody will see from this eclipse. So honestly, yeah, I mean, this is the best place in the world to see it. And it will last for about 2 minutes and 40 seconds. I'm going to be in Wyoming to see it, and I only get 2 minutes and 9 seconds. So you all get 31 seconds more than I do.
Oh, you should have come here.
Well, I wanted to find a place where I knew the weather was going to be good.
There you go. But
it could be cloudy, could be raining. You know, you never know. You can't control that sort of thing. This is something astronomers have been putting up with for thousands of years. So, you know, we're pretty stoic about it. But I'm hoping that Wyoming, which is typically very clear and dry in the summer, is going to be a place for me to see it.
My guest is Phil Plait. You may know him as the Bad Astronomer. He's a blogger and astronomer, as he's, of course, talking about. He's also the head science writer for the Netflix show Bill Nye Saves the World. And I wanted to ask you just really quickly about your work as the head writer. There's 13 episodes from season one that are now available on Netflix. One of the episodes is about chemtrails. Before we listen to clip, can you explain what chemtrails are?
Well, that episode is about pseudoscience. It's just about all kinds of different ways that our thinking goes wrong. And certainly a great example of that is this idea of chemtrails. Basically, you go outside, you look up, and you see these straight lines of clouds going across the sky. These are vapor trails. They're basically just condensation that happens as airplanes fly through the air. It's a very natural physical outcome, especially with jet engines. You get condensation going behind them. And we're used to seeing these things, but a lot of people think that they're actually not just water vapor. They're actually laced with chemicals for whatever reason. Some people think that the government's trying to control our minds or whatever's going on. And so we decided to send our science correspondent, Carly Kloss, to talk to an airplane pilot, about this and to go up and fly with him and take a closer look.
Let's listen to a clip from that episode. It's called Malarkey.
Chemical trails. Is there any truth behind this speculation? I decided to take my inquiry to Tori Ward, a commercial pilot with over 11,000 hours of flight experience and more than 80 types of aircraft. He should have a scientific explanation for what those mysterious streaks in the sky really are.
So Tori, these long white lines that are left in the sky after a jet flies through the air, is there any truth to the theory that there's chemicals that are released by the government?
Absolutely not.
What about to control minds?
No, doesn't exist.
Zombies?
They are very much conspiracy theories. It is a condensation trail. Contrails are formed by generally aircraft at higher altitudes where the temperature is cold enough and also moist enough.
That's a clip from Bill Nye Saves the World. That episode is called Malarkey. Their head writer for it is with me now talking about science, the total eclipse that's supposed to be happening that's next month. Phil, you know, I think many adults today grew up with Bill Nye. He made science really cool. And what's your approach to this show in terms of the topics that you pick, making it both fun, entertaining, and educational?
Well, in fact, when they called me and asked me if I was interested in being a writer on the show, and of course I said yes, they said, what episodes, what sort of topics would you like to cover? And I off the top of my head, I picked off a bunch of things. So let's talk about vaccines. Let's talk about pseudoscience. Let's talk about climate change. And it turns out that of the six or seven things I just thought of immediately, they would already had a list of those as potential topics. So it wasn't too hard to pick these. These are basically topics where either the science isn't necessarily clear on an important topic and is something that we should be talking about, or where the science is clear and people misunderstand it. And I thought that was a really great direction to go for a show headed by Bill Nye, who is not only a familiar face and somebody who knows a lot about the science of this, but is somebody who is passionate about science and about correcting misconceptions people might have.
Yeah, there's one episode about sex where Bill talks about the sexual spectrum. What was the goal of that episode?
Of all the episodes, this was the one I was really interested in working on because it's not something I know a lot about, but I know that some of our writers, we had a team of writers, by the way, including biologists and people who had expertise in a lot of different fields. And although, you know, I'm interested in this topic, the idea of gender and sex and how this all works biologically and how that affects society, it's not something I knew a lot about in detail. And we investigated this and were surprised to find out things like how fluid gender roles can be. And let me say, I'm distinguishing sex and gender as sex as being biological and gender being sort of the societal roles that we assign to these biologies. That's an oversimplification, but for now that'll do. And we found that a lot of countries, like, for example, in Korea, pop music is really far ahead. It's very progressive when it comes to fluidity of gender roles, where male and female overlap. And things that in the United States we might think of as being more masculine or more feminine are shared by both genders. And it was just really neat to see, although we think that human sexuality is very binary, it's you're male or female, that's not what biology tells us at all. In fact, there is a spectrum. And although most people might identify as male or female, that's not at all the case for everybody. And it was a real eye-opener for a lot of us, I think.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that there's a new Chinese boy band that's like they're trying to make the boy band of China and they're all young women. So to that point, it's just interesting. So next month, you're going to be in Wyoming to observe the eclipse. What can people look forward to with your talk this evening?
Well, I'll be talking about a little bit about the history of eclipses and mostly about how they work and why they're so cool. You know, you just don't see these things very often. And when they happen, they're gorgeous, and it's not all the sorts of things you expect. It's like, oh, well, it's going to get a little dark, and that'll be it. It's like, oh, no. There's a whole lot of stuff going on here. Really beautiful, a lot of things to look out for. And basically, I just want people to understand the nature of these things, that this is a beautiful and rare astronomical phenomenon, and that basically, if you can get a chance to go outside and see it, do it.
Phil Plait writes the Bad Astronomy blog. Phil, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us. If you want to send us an email, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to figure out all of our social media handles, you can just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can see the things we're reading. You can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.